The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're recording today's program in one of our apartments in Jerusalem, so hopefully the sound quality won't be too bad for today's show. And, of course, you never know what might happen around an apartment in Jerusalem. Sometimes the city can be quite noisy, but again, hopefully there won't be too many distractions for you, the listening audience, today. Before I tell you a little bit about my trip to Jerusalem here, I thought I could first mention something about my father's travels. He has been down under for the past several days. He arrived in Brisbane, Australia, back last week, I guess Wednesday of last week. He spent the weekend there, Passover, and the first day of Unleavened Bread, and then yesterday, he was down in Sydney, Australia, for a Bible study there. And then today, he's traveling up to Philippines. I think he had about an eight-hour flight from Sydney to the Philippines, where he'll meet with so many of our Filipino brethren, many of our KPCG listeners as well. So he'll be spending a short time with them before making his way back to our Edmond headquarters on Thursday, I believe. So it's definitely a whirlwind trip, and hopefully he'll have plenty to tell us about when he returns. Well, as for my trip, my family also is here with me in Jerusalem. We were able to observe the first Philadelphia Church of God Passover here in Jerusalem on Thursday night, and then the night to be much observed the next evening, Friday evening, and of course the Holy Day over the Sabbath. And we've been here for a couple of days now. After that, quite a few of, well, all of the students and Brent Noctegal and my family, they're off at the Dead Sea today and in Gedi, and I think they're going to visit Masada as well. So finally, the students who've been basically just immersed into the excavation, which ended last Thursday. They've been trying to keep up with their digging responsibilities and also their responsibilities as college students, keeping up with many of their classes online from Edmond, Oklahoma. So it's been a very busy 3 months for them, and they really haven't gotten to do too much traveling except just around Jerusalem. So these next couple of days, they're really looking forward to seeing some of the Bible sites around Israel, in addition to historical sites like Masada. So I'm sure they're having an exciting time today, and hopefully I can get in on some of the fun tomorrow and Wednesday. We'll see how that goes. In any event, we arrived last Thursday morning, just got a few hours of sleep before we then left for the Ophel dig. As I said, that was the last day of the dig. And we were able to basically get there and to see them wrapping things up and collecting all the tools and everything else. We spent some time with Elat Mazar, talked to her, and then, of course, retired back to the apartment for that evening, where we had a wonderful Passover service, and then lots of time together through the weekend. And then last night, my family was able to enjoy a fine meal with Dr. Mazar, and during our get together, she gave me a copy of this massive, it's the second volume of the Ophel excavations. This is the final report, basically, that she puts together following her excavations, and sometimes it takes many years for her to collect all of the data and to analyze everything, and then to put it together in somewhat of a scholarly flow, but also a nice story flow. There's a wonderful chapter in this second volume of the Ophel excavations. It covers the period from 2009 to 2013, during which I think we had three or four excavations where Armstrong College students volunteered. And so there's a lot in this particular volume about the excavations that we were involved in, and also a lot about the Hezekiah Bulla, which was revealed two or three years ago, and then more recently, the Isaiah Bulla. I mean, that was just revealed a few weeks back, a couple of months ago, I guess. But it also is in this second volume report, and there's actually a chapter title in the book called The Rule of Hezekiah in the Light of the New Ophel Excavations. The Rule of Hezekiah, Dr. Mazar says on page 175 of this work, she says, under Hezekiah's rule, Judah became a center for all the people of Israel, including the inhabitants of the former kingdom of Israel, and the temple in Jerusalem played a major role as the holiest place for all. And then she goes on and refers to 2 Kings 18 and verse 5, where it talks about Hezekiah being Judah's greatest king, the second only to King David. And of course, in recent weeks, we've been talking about, Brad McDonald's written a fair bit about this very special relationship that King Hezekiah had with the prophet Isaiah. And so the fact that we have two bulla, one with clearly with the Hezekiah inscription or his name on this this clay seal, and then the other one, the evidence isn't quite as certain, but if you've seen the video that we put together on that or what we wrote at thetrumpet.com, it's some pretty compelling evidence that that belonged to Isaiah the prophet. Some pretty amazing history, and it's all being uncovered right there on the Ophel. This excavation, or this ongoing series of excavations, it's been going on since 2009, and of course it just resumed in January after I think about a four or five year layoff. So it's been a short excavation, but there's also been quite a lot of exciting revelations. Even though the Isaiah Bulla wasn't actually excavated on this particular dig, it was revealed to the general public, as you know, just a couple of months ago, and then more recently, and I know Brent Noctegal has referred to this on his program, Watch Jerusalem. I think he talked about it on his show last night, but just last week, there's been quite a lot of news about this trove of bronze Jewish coins that were unearthed on this particular excavation inside of the cave, where we had diggers, all of them, in fact, came from Armstrong College. In fact, if you, you look at the Jerusalem Post last week, this is from Tuesday, March 27th, so just a week ago, it had a picture of these coins on the front page above the fold, right there again, headlined at the Jerusalem Post. And then the Times of Israel, this is another newspaper from here in Israel, it also featured this story on the front page and at least of its website, and had a nice picture of Cassie Berbout, who is there pointing to or looking at these coins, just to kind of give the reader some perspective or at least some idea of the size of these coins. This Times of Israel piece, by the way, the one with the picture of one of our students, it says here, the trove of dozens of bronze coins minted during the last years of the ill-fated four-year rebellion of the Jews against Roman rule, was uncovered in a cave just south of the Temple Mount by Hebrew University archaeologist Dr. Elat Mazar. So that's the cave that our students have been in these past 3 months. And it says here, the Ophel excavations located below the Temple Mount's southern wall were relaunched in early 2018 after a four-year hiatus. They garnered international headlines after the publication of the recent Prophet Isaiah seal impression, which was discovered in the lead up to the current dig season. It says, the recently discovered bronze coins are remnants left by hidden Jewish residents of besieged Second Temple Jerusalem who sought refuge in the 7 by 14 meter cave in 66 to 70 AD, according to the press release from the Hebrew University. So this cave is enormous, 17 meters by 14. And it basically, like Dr. Mazar says in this clip that we're about to play for you, it's like there was a time capsule, because basically after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, this cave and the entrance to it, it was effectively buried, and only now we're uncovering what remains were there. And it's interesting, too, later on in this piece, it says the Ophel excavations are located within the walls around Jerusalem National Park, and they are funded by the Herbert W. Armstrong College of Edmond, Oklahoma, whose students volunteer there. So a nice little plug there for the college and the fact that this was the first excavation that we actually funded. And there it is in the times of Israel. Just last week. Also last week, we put together a video in which Dr. Mazar was actually in the cave. You can find this at The Key to David City or on YouTube as well. But I'll just play the segment from this video where Dr. Mazar is in the cave and explaining some of the history and some of the significance of this trove of coins, these Jewish coins that were unearthed during this particular excavation. Here's Dr. Mazar.
The cave was used in three major phases. The earliest one is the Hashmonaim one, which we found in quite a thick layer at the bottom of the cave. And this we can see just at the back on the floor of the cave. The pottery and the coins from this layer are very clear Hashmonaim. This is just through the days of King Herod, but not later. The second phase is most interesting one just as well, and it includes remains from the Second Temple period up to 70 CE, to the very destruction of Jerusalem and conquered by the Romans. What we found here, first, it is amazing that such a large cave was sealed since 2,000 years ago and never used again. We know it for certain. The assemblage for the pottery is very significant, only to the Second Temple period and no later than 70 CE. And then we have dozens and dozens of coins. What is so fantastic about these coins is that it does indicate that we're talking about an existing and acknowledgement and use of this cave by the rebels of Jerusalem, the Jewish rebels, up to the very last minute of the last year of the 4 years of the rebellions, meaning the rebellion's 4 years are 66 to 70 CE, meaning to the last minute of 70. How we know that? The coins bear the symbols, Jewish symbols, the four pieces of biblical times that we know that were used in the temple, and also a goblet that was used in the temple, symbols, Jewish symbols that are very very well known. But in addition to these symbols, there is a clear Hebrew inscription saying, "To the freedom of Zion," and in the last year, it came to be to the redemption of Zion. And it says, year two or year three, and the last year is year four. So on one side to the redemption of Zion, on the other side, year four. And such coins, very clear, because they were not used for a long time and maybe not so used at all. Last year they were mint, and we have dozens of these coins in this cave. So it's not an unusual phenomena that we can come to such a closed cave, untouched, 2,000 years, including the very last remains of life of the people who were sieged in Jerusalem, suffered in Jerusalem, to the very last minute of the Second Temple period. So this cave that we concluded this season to excavate is of a specific and most interesting story in the history of Jerusalem.
That is Dr. Elat Mazar from a video that we produced last week, and that video was embedded in some of the newspaper coverage on this story just last week as well. So some pretty exciting developments, lots of exciting coverage during this particular excavation at the Ophel. last night during our dinner meeting with Dr. Mazar, she talked about the next big phase on the Ophel. There's a much bigger chunk of territory that needs to be excavated. I think this would be at the northeastern corner, and it's quite, I mean, there's quite a lot to get down to. She says it's probably about 10 meters deep before you get down to the really good stuff. So we're talking about a bigger area and lots of earth to sift through. I asked her last night, by the way, so how she thinks this will probably be like a six-month dig, and I asked her how many people she thought she would need for this, and she said as many as possible. So hopefully the Armstrong College can help support this in any way possible and provide the kind of support in terms of numbers of diggers that we did just this past excavation. If not more, we'll have to see what happens. We just kind of take it from day to day, and we don't know for sure when it will start or whether it'll be during the summer or during a school semester like it was this past excavation. In any event, she knows, and I think many of you listeners know, that whatever happens, whenever it happens, we'll certainly be ready to support her work. Well, before we take a break, I thought I would just mention another significant anniversary, maybe not one that we necessarily celebrate, but it was on this day back in 2001, so that would be 17 years ago today, April 2nd, 2001. This is the day that the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to hear our appeal in the litigation over Mystery of the Ages. If you remember some of that history, and you can study this in Raising the Ruins, but we had won at the district level in Judge Lett's courtroom, and then the Worldwide appealed that to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Ninth Circuit overturned Judge Lett's ruling. I think that was in late 2000. They overturned it by a ruling of 2-1 or 2-1 voting in favor of the Worldwide Church of God. And so then we submitted an appeal to the Supreme Court, the highest court in America. And as we told the Supreme Court, look, they're just all this talk about using their copyrights or e-publishing their works. This is nothing but a litigation ploy on their part. What they really want to do is suppress Mystery of the Ages. We actually wrote in the brief we submitted to the Supreme Court, we said, while anyone should be free to debate the validity of the creator's ideas, no one should have the power to suppress those ideas simply because he or she disagrees with them. And that's what they were aiming to do. They wanted to suppress the ideas or teachings of Herbert Armstrong. So we submitted that appeal to the Supreme Court. And on this day, 17 years ago, the Supreme Court chose not to hear our case. They let the Ninth Circuit's reversal stand. There may have been a number of reasons for that. I know, as we point out in Raising the Ruins, the litigation surrounding the case hadn't really been completed. We hadn't gone through the damages trial yet. And of course, we had our counterclaim where we were suing them for the rights to print or distribute 18 other works of Mr. Armstrong's. So in any event, on this day 17 years ago, I know the lawyers and the representatives for the Worldwide Church of God, they were cheering. They were thinking that it was over, that the PCG had lost, that there was no way the PCG was going to obtain the rights to Mystery of the Ages and those other works. They thought it was all over. And yet, as our lawyers told us, look, there's lots of litigation left to sort out in this case. And so we stayed the course. And, you can read the rest of the story in Raising the Ruins. When we come back, we'll get into some news items for today. I'll talk a little bit about the March of Return. I know, again, Brent Noctegal has discussed this recently on his program. I think it was touched upon in Friday's Trumpet Hour as well. In any event, it's big news over here, and we'll look at that coming up in the next segment, as well as some other news items that we want to draw attention to. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, You can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions: Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
And welcome back to the program. Sam informs me that we have a bit of an echo with today's recording, but unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to fix that at this late stage. But in any event, as I said at the start of the program, we were taping this from one of our apartments in Jerusalem. So hopefully the quality again isn't too bad. Well, this March of Return, as it's been called, I think it was now 17 people that were killed on Friday, these protests in Gaza right at the Israeli border. And it's interesting, just like with the protests coming from the youth in America, that March for Life back in, a couple of weeks ago. I went through it on this program with you, how that the major media, they're just not giving you the whole story there. They're trying to conceal the fact that there are radical left-wing adult organizations that are behind these protests, that are actually busing in these children. And they won't tell you that because they want you to think that these are just young people that are spontaneously rising up to protest for more gun control. Well, if you look at some of the major media coverage of the protest on Friday, again, you could be forgiven for thinking the same thing, that this was just some sort of spontaneous demonstration. In fact, this was organized and funded by Hamas. Hamas has budgeted something like $10 million for this operation, this March of Return, which is to go from March 30th, that was Friday, all the way through to May 15th, the day of the 70th anniversary of Israel's establishment, the day the Palestinians refer to as Nakba, or Catastrophe Day. It's a catastrophe, the day that Israel was established as a state. And of course, as you know, it's written right into Hamas's charter that we want to obliterate Israel. They don't recognize Israel. They don't recognize the state of Israel. And so they've been trying, ever since taking over Gaza, they've been trying to wipe Israel out, whether it's with firing rockets or digging tunnels into Israel where they can kidnap soldiers or Israeli citizens. And now they're resorting to this, pushing their women and children to the front of these protests. And then, of course, sprinkled in among them are these heavily armed Hamas terrorists. and some of them firing on Israeli positions. There's video of that that the IDF released over the weekend. Terrorists firing upon Israeli positions. And yet if you just look at the, again, the major coverage, you would think that of the 16 or 17 people that were killed, they're just all innocent civilians that were minding their own business, carrying a sign, gunned down by the Israelis. Here's a typical response. This is Bernie Sanders. He ran for president in 2016 there in the United States. This is Bernie Sanders, an exchange that he had with Jake Tapper yesterday.
The Israeli government called the protests, quote, violent terror demonstrations. The ambassador of Israel to the United Nations said Hamas fighters were interspersed throughout the crowd using human shields and were killed after making, quote, direct attacks on Israeli positions. Do you not accept the Israeli government's explanation?
No, I don't. I think from what my understanding is you have tens and tens of thousands of people who are engaged in a nonviolent protest. I believe now 15 or 20 people, Palestinians, have been killed, and many, many others have been wounded. So I think it's a difficult situation, but my assessment is that Israel overreacted on that.
That's Bernie Sanders yesterday saying that Israel overreacted on Friday. Sanders, I mean, he's a Jew himself. His father had family members murdered in the Holocaust. And yet here he is saying that what Israel does is unacceptable, defending its border because of these demonstrations, the way that he sees it. That's all that he sees it as, a simple demonstration. I just want to take you through a couple of articles. I think Brent Noctegal might have referred to these. This first one, anyway, I know we linked to it at our Watch Jerusalem website, but it's a piece by David Horovitz. He writes at the Times of Israel, and of course, he's defending Israel. He's one of the few who does. But we'll compare this, just contrast what he has to say. And he brings up some history here, really some recent history. And we'll compare this with how the New York Times covered those protests on Friday. First, though, David Horovitz in the Times of Israel, he says, just in case anybody forgot, Israel unilaterally withdrew from the Gaza Strip to the pre-1967 lines in 2005. It uprooted thousands of Israeli settlers from their homes. It dismantled all military infrastructure in the Strip. It has no physical presence there. It makes no territorial claims there. That happened just 13 years ago. Israel pulling out of the Gaza Strip, I think it was something like 9 or 10,000 Israelis and all of their families uprooted, pulled out. The homes that were there just handed over to Hamas, or I guess at the time, to the Palestinians. And then Hamas carried out its violent takeover of Gaza in 2007, as Horovitz covers in his piece. Just in case you forgot, here's what happened. Just a few years ago, this violent takeover. And then Horovitz says here, having attempted to terrorize Israel into capitulation with its strategic onslaught of suicide bombers in the Second Intifada, it has since, grabbing hold of Gaza, continued its efforts to terrorize Israel by firing thousands upon thousands of rockets indiscriminately across the border. Horovitz says, were it not for the Iron Dome rocket defense system, much of Israel would, as Hamas had hoped, been reduced to rubble. It says Hamas has been incessantly digging attack tunnels under the border, another terror avenue that Israel appears to have gradually been closing off with new technology and underground barriers. So Israel has this sophisticated Iron Dome technology to shoot down many of the rockets that come, or at least the ones that are coming into major population centers. And then now they're developing this new technology to clamp down on the tunnels, to close off the tunnels, to build underground barriers that prevent Hamas from tunneling into Israel And so as he brings out now, I mean, this is their latest attempt to attack Israel. He says here, just in case anybody forgot, Hamas has cynically and relentlessly exploited Gazans, a large proportion of whom have supported it in elections, by storing its rockets near or even inside mosques and schools, firing rockets from residential areas, and digging tunnels from beneath homes and civilian institutions. It has subverted all materials that can be utilized for the manufacture of weaponry, necessitating a stringent Israeli security blockade whose main victims are ordinary Gazans. Yes, there is a blockade. It's not 100%, but for the most part, Israel does watch carefully what enters into Gaza, because if it's any kind of material that can be utilized for manufacturing weapons, Israel obviously doesn't allow it to go in, because Hamas will take it and build weapons, rockets. It says organizing and encouraging mass demonstrations at the border in the so-called March of Return to face off against Israeli troops while sanctimoniously and disingenuously branding the campaign nonviolent is merely the latest iteration of Hamas's cynical use of Gazans as human shields for its aggression. And even still, look at how careful Israel has to be to shoot only, well, sparingly. You may have seen some pictures. Well, you probably haven't, unless you maybe search through some Israeli sources. The pictures of most of these casualties from Friday, these are young men in their 20s or early 30s. These are military-aged men. These were terrorists, most of them. These were not civilians. These were not women and children that were just indiscriminately gunned down by Israeli forces. These were terrorists, in some cases, firing at Israeli posts. And so here is Horovitz just bringing up some recent history from the past 12 or 13 years. And then look at who's behind these demonstrations. Hamas, again, using women and children as human shields. This is what they've done. Why would they do it? Well, I'll get to that when we go through some of Carolyn Glick's piece. But first, I want to compare this with how the New York Times covered the demonstrations from Friday. It says, this is the New York Times from Saturday, tens of thousands of Palestinians gathered along Gaza's border with Israel on Friday to vent their pent-up frustration in a protest that quickly turned violent. So they're frustrated. They have pent-up frustration, and they're protesting that, the way that the Times sees it. It says it estimated it at 30,000 people. It was billed as the start of a peaceful six-week sit-in. It says they were protesting against Israel's long-standing blockade of the territory and in support of their claims to return to homes in what is now Israel. So it's not enough that Israel pulled out of Gaza. It's not enough that Israel uprooted 9 or 10,000 of its own people. They want to return en masse to Israel. It says, but as some began hurling stones, tossing Molotov cocktails, and rolling burning tires at the fence, the Israelis responded with tear gas and gunfire. The New York Times says the Israelis said they also exchanged fire with two gunmen across the fence and fired at two others who tried to infiltrate into Israel. It's interesting, anytime they're quoting or referring to what Israel's side of the story, the Times says the Israelis said they also exchanged fire, as if, you know, we're not real sure about that. I mean, we'll take Hamas's word for it. This was billed as the start of a peaceful six-week sit-in. That's the way Hamas is selling it. And the New York Times just laps it up. And then if Israel comes out and says, look, they're firing at us and we're returning fire, the New York Times says, well, this is Israel's side of the story, but we don't know for sure if that's the truth. The Times says, Friday's flare-up, ignited by isolation and economic deprivation, was the worst in years in the small Mediterranean enclave. That's what started it, the way the Times sees it. It was ignited by isolation and economic deprivation. In other words, it's Israel's fault. Israel is isolating Gaza. Israel is depriving Gaza. Economic deprivation is what ignited this flare-up. Well, it says here, finally, in December, some Palestinian leaders had called for mass protests when the U.S. declared Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and said it planned to move the American embassy there. The demonstrations never materialized. It says here, the Palestinian organizers of the protest bust. This is within, it's embedded within the article. You get a little bit of insight, even in the New York Times piece, of who is behind this. It says the Palestinian organizers, that would be Hamas, okay? Hamas controls Gaza. The Palestinian organizers of the protest bust women, children, to the tent encampments that popped up in recent days about 700 yards from the border with Israel. So they bust them in, just like the radicals bust in the youth to the protest in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. You see the radicals behind it, time and time again. And the major media, time and time again, working overtime to conceal the truth. To conceal the truth. It says finally in the New York Times, well, just to paraphrase, it's to continue through May 15th, Nakba Day, but also that date is particularly sensitive, the Times brings out, because that's the day after the expected move of the United States Embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. So there's lots of things at play here. But let me just give you the conclusion, or this is near the conclusion of that New York Times article. It says organizers of the border protest had hoped to create an almost festival-like atmosphere to attract families, setting up portable washrooms and providing free food, water, and Wi-Fi. So well, it was a carnival. The organizers, that would be Hamas. Hamas trying to lure the women and children, the families, out to this festival-like atmosphere, and then sprinkled in among the civilians are these heavily armed terrorists. What a shame that there aren't more Western news sources that are telling you the truth. Carolyn Glick, she had a powerful post on Friday or Saturday about how that, well, as she typically does, she just breaks it down to what the real motivation is here and why Hamas is carrying this out. She says, the first question that observers of this spectacle need to ask themselves is whether Hamas believes that it will be able to overrun Israel. The obvious answer is, of course, it doesn't. So this brings us to the second question. If Hamas doesn't expect its civilians to overrun Israel, what is it trying to accomplish by sending them into harm's way? Why is the terror group telling Gaza residents to place themselves in front of the border fence and challenge Israeli security forces charged with defending Israel? She says the answer here is also obvious. Hamas intends to provoke Israel to shoot at the Palestinian civilians it's sending to the border. It's setting its people up to die because it expects their deaths to be captured live by the cameras of the Western media, which will be on hand to watch the spectacle. This is the Hamas leadership sacrificing their own women and children because they know the Western media will be there to capture it live on television and then blame Israel. She says, in other words, Hamas's strategy of harming Israel by forcing its soldiers to kill Palestinians is predicated on its certainty that the Western media will act as its partner and ensure the success of its lethal propaganda stunt. Some sharp analysis here coming from Carolyn Glick. Well, she even talks about the bigger picture here and how Iran is looming behind the scenes, lurking behind the scenes, keen to start another war with Israel using its proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah. Carolyn Glick concludes here by saying, if this border assault does in fact serve as the opening act in a larger terror war against Israel, then a large portion of the blame for the bloodshed will rest on the shoulders of the Western media for empowering the terrorists of Hamas and Hezbollah to attack Israel. That's the truth. That's the truth. And you're not going to get much of it from the New York Times. You have to go over to Carolyn Glick or find out what David Horowitz is saying at the Times of Israel just to get to the truth. I mean, look at the spat yesterday between Erdogan in Turkey and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Erdogan came out and called Netanyahu a terrorist for the way that Israel responded to those terrorists coming out of Gaza on Friday. And usually Israel just ignores those kinds of insults, but I guess this one was too much for Netanyahu. Coming from Erdogan, of all people, this piece in the Jerusalem Post, talking about what Erdogan said, I'm trying to skim through it to see what was Netanyahu's response. I think he called Erdogan a butcher. So Erdogan says of Netanyahu, you're a terrorist. And then Netanyahu responded by saying, well, you're butchering your own people. And the New York, or rather, this is the Jerusalem Post. It says on January 20th, so this is just earlier this year, just a couple of months ago, it says Turkey began a cross-border military operation against the Kurdish People's Protection Units in Afrin, an operation for which Turkey has come under widespread international criticism. Well, maybe so, but certainly not as widespread as the criticism is when Israel does anything to defend itself. The Post says here, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reported that 289 civilians have been killed since Ankara began this military operation. This is Turkey in January. This is Erdogan in January. It says other estimates put that number as high as 510 amid allegations of indiscriminate Turkish artillery fire. There have also been reports of Turkish border guards shooting refugees fleeing the fighting and seeking shelter inside Turkey. And so here is a case where civilians actually are being gunned down, and it's happening in Turkey. It's spearheaded by Turkey's leader, Turkey's dictator and tyrant, Erdogan. And yet he comes out yesterday and criticizes Netanyahu and all the Western media. They love that. They love it when Israel is singled out. But where was Bernie Sanders when this massacre was happening in Turkey just in January, just 2 months ago? Did Bernie Sanders come forward and say, look, this is unacceptable, what Erdogan is doing? No, that outrage, I mean, that criticism, that's reserved only for Netanyahu. That's reserved for Israel. Richard sent me a bunch of articles today about all of these anti-Semitic acts against Jews in Europe, Germany, in France, all across the continent. I mean, this hatred for Jews, like my father says in the Key of David booklet. This is on page 88 of his booklet, The Key of David. He says, why is there so much hatred of the Jews? Look at the Middle East today, he said. The Jews of the tiny nation of Israel are despised by their neighbors. And the truth of it is, they're despised by many in the West. They're despised by the major media. He says many Arabs want to see the Jewish nation destroyed. In our time, the Jews have been hated in Russia. There's still anti-Semitism in the United States and other countries. And can we forget what Hitler and his Nazi scourge did to the Jews? Where is all this hate coming from? He says, a thinking person has to wonder. Well, he goes on and talks more about that in the Key of David booklet. You can get to that booklet online at thetrumpet.com. There's other prophecies we could dwell on here as well in Hosea 5 and Zechariah 14, the division of Jerusalem that's coming soon. I mean, just following this so-called march of return in Gaza, carrying on through the middle of May, we'll have to certainly keep our eyes on that to see if this does escalate into a full-scale war, which is what Iran really and truly wants. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're running out of time on today's program, but when we return, we'll spend a few minutes at the close of the show reverting back to Hezekiah, as I touched on at the start of the program, and end the show today with a bit of a Bible study in coming from 2 Chronicles. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
I don't have a lot of time left for today's show, but I thought I'd conclude with a short study on Hezekiah. We've said so much in recent weeks about this special relationship between the king, King Hezekiah, and the prophet Isaiah. And when the Hezekiah bullet first came out, we revealed the story about Isaiah just a few weeks back. But when the Hezekiah bullet came out there at the end of 2015, I believe it was, my father followed that up with an article in the Trumpet magazine about what King Hezekiah can teach us, what it can teach us. And he referred to that verse that Dr. Mazar refers to in her Ophel excavations report, her final report, the verse in 2 Kings 18 that says that there was none like him, like Hezekiah, among the kings of Judah. I mean, he was second only to King David. If you look at 2 Chronicles 29, I just want to hit a few high spots from these two chapters, wonderful chapters toward the end of 2 Chronicles, about Hezekiah's reign and how that he did that which was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that David, his father, had done. He just followed in the steps of David. That's why he was a successful king. That's why he had such a successful reign, because he followed in the steps of King David. He cleansed the temple. He purified the priesthood. He pointed the nation back to David. He got rid of all the spiritual filthiness in the nation. My father, in that 2016 article, he says it's amazing what one man can do when he zealously commits himself to God. It is amazing. Verse 30 here in 2 Chronicles 29, it says, "Moreover, Hezekiah the king and the princes commanded the Levites to sing praise unto the Eternal with the words of David and of Asaph the seer," it says, "and they sang praises with gladness, and they bowed their heads and worshiped." And so he came along and he reestablished this beautiful, uplifting, inspiring music as part of the temple service. I mean, under Hezekiah's leadership, the Jews were praising God with their whole hearts. Here was God's nation, the people of God, returning back to the basics of how to worship and praise and thank God. Verse 31, it says, "Then Hezekiah answered and said, Now you have consecrated yourselves unto the Eternal. Come near and bring sacrifices and thank offerings," it says, "unto the house of the Eternal. And the congregation brought in sacrifices and thank offerings, and as many as were of a free heart, burnt offerings." That's what it is when we give to God, when we support God's work through our tithes and offerings. It's an opportunity for us to express thanks to God, to be a cheerful giver, as Paul said in the New Testament. Hezekiah restored this generous spirit of cheerful giving. Here again, following in the steps of his father David. Well, during this restoration, it says in verse 34, but the priests were too few so that they could not flay all the burnt offerings. Wherefore their brethren, the Levites, did help them till the work was ended, until the other priests had sanctified themselves, for the Levites were more upright in heart to sanctify themselves than the priests. Quite a few things revealed in that verse. Firstly, that there were just so many people contributing. The priests were too few, it says. They couldn't process all the sacrifices and the offerings. There was a need for more people to step up and to lead. And that's what some among the Levites did. And God praised them here in this passage, saying that the Levites were more upright in heart than even the priests. Here were people that maybe didn't have the exalted positions that some others had, and yet they stepped up to the tasks at hand. They made a worthy contribution, and God singled them out for praise, saying their hearts were right. We're all being judged and measured according to how much our heart is in God's work. Whether we're priests, Levites, or, you know, the leaders, the commoners, whoever. All being measured. It says in verse 35, and also the burnt offerings were in abundance with the fat of the peace offerings and the drink offerings for every burnt offering, it says, so that the service of the house of the Eternal was set in order. And Hezekiah rejoiced, and all the people. And the people had prepared, or rather, and God had prepared the people, for the thing was done suddenly. Look at how fast they were able to get things back on track. Look at how much can be accomplished in just a short period of time if everyone's unified and working diligently together. I mentioned this to the students over the weekend. Here we have just 11 or 12 volunteers. A short excavation, less than 3 months. And yet look at how much can be accomplished in the cave or with videos and publications or breathtaking finds out in the field. The Isaiah Bulla, this treasure trove of coins from the Roman period, right before the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. You look at God's work today, not just the recent excavation, but you look at God's work and how much has happened just in the last year. The growth. I talked about my father's trip to Australia and the Philippines aboard the G450. We've not even had that for a full year. I think we received delivery on that April 12th. So we're coming up to the one-year anniversary, and here we are today, and my father's traveling halfway around the world on God's plane, the plane that God provided for this church. Look at how much has happened, or how much has been done suddenly. Well, if you continue your study into the next chapter, we won't have time to really get into it much here, but Hezekiah, he was working so diligently, and then he sends out this invitation to all of the people up north, the Israelites, the scattered Israelites that were still there following their captivity, and tells them, look, come down to Judah, come down to Jerusalem, and keep the days, keep and observe these days, these feast days. And of course, most of the Israelites up north, they just ridiculed him. They mocked him to scorn. They could have turned their lives around, their families, their communities, had they obeyed God the way that Hezekiah did. What an example there is for us with this king and that special relationship he had with God's prophet. We'll have to spend more time on that part of it, that part of the story, at another time. We're out of time. For this program, we're out of time, so I'll have to close off our study there and continue when I'm with you next time, hopefully from here in Jerusalem, or at least from Israel later this week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, as always, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.